The Judiciary Committee will come to order. Lindsay, please call the roll.
Chair Grawl.
Present.
Vice Chair Byrd.
Here.
Republican Whip Gregory.
Here.
Ranking Member Driscoll.
Here.
Representatives Alexander, Beltran.
Here.
Brannon.
Here.
Busada Cabrera.
Here.
Diamond.
Here.
Duggan.
Here.
Fernandez Barquin. Fetterhoff.
Here.
Gottlieb is excused. Grieco.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Learned.
Here.
Plakin. Roach.
Present.
Salzman.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Trunow.
Thank you, Lindsay. Let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Before we begin, a few reminders. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, as a reminder for our members and presenter, please ensure that when you are speaking, to turn your microphone on, and when you are finished speaking, to turn your microphone off. Welcome back, members. Today we have a presentation on the calculation of admissibility of damages in tort cases. Joining us today is Judge Myers from the Ninth Judicial Circuit to educate us on this topic. This topic comes up frequently within the Florida legislature, therefore I thought it was, and it's definitely within the purview of this committee, and that's why we'll be having this presentation today. Judge Myers was elected in 2010 as Circuit Court Judge for the Ninth Judicial Circuit, Orange and Osceola Counties, Florida. His term began in January of 2011. Judge Myers first served in Osceola County from January 2011 to December 2012 in the Unified Family Court, which includes domestic relations, juvenile delinquency, and domestic repeat sexual dating stalking violence injunctions. He was assigned to Orange County Circuit Criminal Division, presiding over felony criminal cases. Thereafter, he served 3.5 years in General Civil Division and had the honor of being assigned as one of two judges in the Complex Business Division of the court. He served as Chief Judge from 2019 to 2021. Judge Myers, welcome to the Judiciary Committee today. He has prepared a presentation, members, for all of us. It's my understanding that there are some natural divisions within the presentation that will allow for some questions. So we're going to allow Judge Myers to identify those times in which you are all welcome and encouraged to ask questions about the presentation today. Thank you, Judge Myers.
Good morning, everybody. Chair Grawl, Vice Chair Byrd, thank you for having me today. It's really an honor to be able to be here to share with you from a judicial perspective, a boots on the ground sort of perspective about damages in Florida tort actions. And I think it might be helpful just to know a little bit about more about me other than just my judicial career. I'm honored to have done that, but I was a courtroom lawyer for 21 years before I was elected to serve on the bench. And I spent my time in courtrooms trying cases, arguing legal issues, and all of the things that courtroom lawyers do while they're down there at the courthouse. I've had the privilege of serving in nearly every division inside of our courthouse as a judge. Some people would say I can't find a way to keep a job. I've moved around division to division, but I've gained a reputation as a problem solver in some of those divisions and able to successfully move through that. It was my highest honor to serve as the Chief Judge in the Ninth Judicial Circuit. If you don't know, Orange and Osceola County is the third largest circuit in the state. We now have 69 judges as a result of your good work. Thank you for that. Grateful to have those resources as we are working through our pandemic backloads and all of those cases. I am currently planning my retirement. I'll be retiring in January from the bench, and so I'm a short timer. When Chair Grawl asked me to come and present on this topic, I thought what a privilege it would be to talk about the admissibility and the calculation of damages in our civil tort cases, and to do it from a neutral position. On the bench where I have no stake in the outcome. So I consider it a privilege and want to thank you for the chance to be here. If I were a trial lawyer standing in front of you, I'd have the opportunity to conduct some voir dire, learn a little bit more about you. I've read your bios and I think I have some base understanding of where you all are. But I thought it might be helpful for us to do a little bit of background work. It looks like just more than half of the committee have law degrees. Some of you, I think, are aspiring to get one when we're finished today. Representative Learned, thank you. I can't promise you we'll get quite that far, but we'll cover this niche of it, I think, in a comprehensive fashion. I would ask you this question, though, if you wouldn't mind, just by a show of hands, how many of you have had an opportunity to serve on a jury? All right, that's a pretty good representation. How about a civil jury as opposed to a criminal jury? All right, not a single hand. I understand. Most of our cases being tried, obviously, in the trial courts are criminal cases. So we're going to focus today, though, on the civil arena. Some of you may be familiar with the concepts we're going to talk about. Some of you not so familiar. I do encourage you to ask questions as we're moving through, because I want to make sure that we're continuing to be on the same page. We're going to cover five major areas today. We're going to cover the background on torts and the elements of a negligence claim. Some of you may hear that word tort and think we're headed to dessert. That's not the case. We're going to talk about a specific kind of a civil case. Then we're going to do an introduction to damages in the negligence case. We're going to talk about the evidence for and against damages in a civil case. And we're going to hear what is it that a jury can see and hear in making a determination on damages, and what is it that a jury does not see or hear in making their determination on damages. Then we're going to talk through a typical jury verdict and some of the instructions that a jury is given, so you'll know how it is that they're calculating the damages that are awarded in a verdict. And finally, we'll talk about post-verdict activities, those things that the court does in follow-up to a trial to ensure the fairness of the outcome, which I think is obviously one of our major concerns in the court system. So we're going to begin with our presentation, and I want to first express my appreciation to the Office of State Court Administrator for their assistance in preparing the materials that are going to be a part of the slide presentation today. Really just a fabulous job, Toshiba. Robinson, thank you so much, and we have our executive director as well, Ali Sackett, with us. So we're going to move straight into an explanation of what a tort is. Very simply, a tort can be defined as a wrongful act, sometimes a wrongful omission or failure to act, for which the law provides a civil remedy. No criminal remedies, nobody's going to jail in a tort case. Just talking about damages associated with that and trying to remedy the wrong. And the primary purpose of tort law is exactly that. It is to compensate an injured person for the damages that they have suffered as a result of the wrongful act or omission of another person. Generally, personal injury torts fall into three categories. We have intentional torts, and you're probably familiar with some of these. They sound like crimes, but they are also civil actions. Assault and battery are two examples of intentional torts. Other examples you might be familiar with are false imprisonment, malicious prosecution, defamation, fraud. All of those can be intentional torts. That's where the wrongdoer has acted intentionally to cause harm to somebody else. Second major category, and the one we're really going to spend most of our time focusing on, are negligent torts. Things like automobile accidents, which make up the vast majority of the cases that are being tried and resolved inside of our circuit courts. It also includes things like medical malpractice, other professional negligence or malpractice claims, and slip and fall. And the negligence standard generally is the standard of the failure to act in a reasonable fashion, the way that a reasonable person would have acted in that circumstance, or failing to do something that a reasonable person would have done under the same or similar circumstances. Those are the negligence types of claims. And the final type of torts are strict liability torts. These are actions that if taken, the wrongdoer is strictly liable for. You don't have to prove that they acted in negligence, but they are strictly liable. They are liable as a matter of law. For example, if they put a defective product into the stream of commerce, or animal attacks, most familiar probably with dog bites, but also if you possess a wild animal and that wild animal causes harm, you are strictly liable for the actions of that animal. So Article 1, Section 22 of the Florida Constitution guarantees the right to a civil jury trial for an aggrieved individual. I know you're generally familiar with that. All of the actions, or most of the actions, if not all of them, that take place in the circuit court in the civil arena are performed before a jury. And a jury is the decider of the facts in that case. We call them the trier of fact. The judge is the decider of the law and gives the law to the jury so that the jury can make a decision based upon the facts that they determine on the outcome of a case. So we're going to talk a lot about what a jury does. That's the key here, a jury. And in Florida, our juries for civil cases are generally made up of 6 individuals. Sometimes we'll have an alternate or 2 that sits with that jury. But we also occasionally have juries of 12. In an eminent domain case, for example, there might be a larger jury that sits to hear those issues. So we're going to talk at this point about proving a personal injury claim of negligence. But before I do that, I would just open the floor. Any questions about this concept of tort law and the negligence actions that we're going to be talking about? Yes, Representative Beltran. Sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't mean to take
that's okay.
Thank you, Chair. As a judge and a chair, so I'll take whatever the recognition comes from. But anyway, thank you for being here today. Just have a quick question. You kind of piqued my curiosity. You've obviously been on the bench for some time. Have you ever seen a tort trial where there was no jury demand ever? I'm just kind of, you piqued my curiosity. I'm just curious.
In my practice, I agreed to try a tort case before a judge. I waived my right to a jury trial in a case, but I have not seen that in my time on the bench. And it was a case strategically where we didn't think it was necessary to consume the resources to impanel a jury and felt very comfortable with the judge making a decision. But it is a rarity. In 11 years, I can't recall even a colleague telling me that they've had somebody who waived their right to a jury trial.
Representative Roach, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just curious, what is the rationale behind expanding the size of the jury for something like an eminent domain case from 6 to 12?
The eminent domain cases come with a very rich constitutional history and a right of protection for landowners not to have their property taken without just compensation. And I can't tell you specifically that I know the reason, but I think it is the idea that this is one of the very highest constitutional elements of a trial that we engage in. Eminent domain trials are rare. In my division, I have not had an eminent domain case ever. And I think in our courthouse, we may have tried 2 in the last 11 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're recognized.
Okay, thank you. So let's move on to the elements of proving a personal injury claim. Again, this is the lion's share of the cases that we are resolving in the circuit courts, are these negligence cases. To prove a negligence claim, the plaintiff has to meet these 4 criteria. The first is duty. You must establish at the time and place where this incident occurred, the circumstances were such that the wrongdoer had a duty to act in a manner that was safe and protective of the victim. It is a legal question. The court decides whether there was a duty or not. Typical circumstances where we have duties are where the traffic laws, for example, impose a duty on a driver. The circumstances are such that a operator of a vehicle should not rear-end another vehicle. That's where there is a duty to drive in a safe and careful manner. And we have a number of our traffic statutes that impose those types of duty for individuals who are out driving on the roadways. As I said, it is a question of law for the court to determine whether a duty exists. And there are many circumstances where that duty question arises. It happens fairly commonly. It's not obviously your routine auto traffic case. But sometimes in medical malpractice cases, for example, there is a question raised about whether a medical provider owes a duty to a patient for a certain thing. A unique case came before me where the power went out in the NICU of a hospital. And the question was, did the hospital have a duty to ensure backup systems to protect the patients in the hospital who were dependent upon the machinery that was keeping them alive in the NICU? That's a question that isn't well settled in the law. The parties came to the court and asked for a decision, typically in the summary judgment context, asking the court to say as a matter of law whether a duty existed on the part of the hospital. So we see those fairly regularly. Some other duties that you may be familiar with are in the landowner or property areas, slip and fall cases. We have a statute that was passed by the legislature that addresses slip and fall liability in the context of a store owner. And that, by law, defines what the duty is. But generally, a guest or business invitee on somebody's property is owed the duty by the landowner not to harm them and to warn them of any known dangers that may be existing on the property. So those are typical types of duty questions that arise before the court. So once a duty is established, the next piece or element of the offense is a breach of that duty. That is to show that the alleged wrongdoer did something that would be contrary to the duty that he owed to the people around him. That element of breach is sometimes the subject of litigation in lawsuits. We talk about that commonly and wrongly, but commonly in terms of negligence. Negligence are these four things. What we're really meaning is liability. Has somebody done something for which they can be held liable or responsible? Causation is probably the most heatedly contested of all of the issues in an element for the claim of negligence. Did the breach of the duty cause damages that are alleged? And so in a typical injury case, the focus is on the medical testimony. Doctors, radiologists, orthopedics, neurosurgeons coming in to testify that this person suffered an injury to a disc. And that happened as a result of this accident, not as a result of the normal aging process or an aggravation of something that's happened during the aging process. It is, as I said, the key component, and it can simply be defined as, but for the negligence, this damage would not have occurred. That's causation, but for. The final element, and the one that we're going to focus on today, are the damages themselves. In order to pursue a claim, it's not enough that somebody ran a stop sign, hit your car. You cannot bring a claim for personal injuries unless that caused you injuries. You could bring a claim for property damage, but you couldn't bring a claim for injuries. You have to have some damages associated with that. And so we're going to talk some about that. In a basic fundamental understanding, it is the claimant, or the plaintiff is the word we use once we're in a lawsuit, who bears the burden of proof on those damages. The burden of proof under our law is the greater weight of the evidence, which means the more persuasive and convincing force and effect of the entire evidence in the case. That's the definition that the jury is given on the burden of proof. The more convincing and persuasive force and effect of the entire evidence in the case. The defendant, while they don't bear a burden, has the absolute right to challenge and to present evidence of their own on all of these elements of the claim. And that's an important thing to remember. We don't allow a plaintiff to waltz into the courtroom to simply tell their story and ask a jury to award them something. There's another party. It is an adversarial system. And we depend upon that adversarial system to get to the truth. We talk about trials in courtrooms as the crucible in which truth is exposed. Because you have two parties that are fighting their hardest to persuade a jury of the rightness of their case. And so when we talk about each element of these damages, it isn't just the plaintiff's burden and the method by which they can prove that. It is also the defense right to contest, challenge, and bring witnesses of their own to contest that as well. So when we talk about the standard personal injury claim and proof, two issues are liability, which we've covered. It is the breach of that duty, and that it is the causation of damages. What are the nature and extent of the damages that have been suffered by a plaintiff in a case like this? This is probably another good breaking point, Chair Grawl, for for questions.
Senator Beltran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm sorry, it's killing me. What happened in the NICU power outage case? You didn't tell us. I'm sorry to bother you, but I'm curious now.
Not a bother. I can tell you my ruling was I believe that a hospital has a duty to ensure that there are backup systems in place, to ensure that the machinery that is protecting the lives of those who are truly helpless. I mean, these aren't folks who check themselves into the hospital and have a choice about where to go. These are infants who are there only by virtue of the risks associated with the mortality at that point. And I think that hospitals do have that duty. Interestingly, in that case, they had backup generators. And the backup generators were caused to fail, as it turns out, by an electrician who was doing some work and who shorted out the system. So,
any other questions? I think that's all. All right. You're recognized.
All right, thank you. All right, so let's begin our conversation around the topic of damages. There are three categories of damages that are recoverable in personal injury negligence claims. The first is economic damages. These are damages that are designed to reimburse claimants for their objective, verifiable financial losses that are stemming from the tortious conduct. Economic damages, we'll talk about in just a minute and detail some of those for you. The next are non-economic damages. These are damages that compensate a plaintiff for non-economic or intangible damages. Some plaintiff's attorneys refer to these as human damages. They're the loss of the quality of life, for example, scarring, disfigurement, those types of things. And the final category of damages are punitive damages. Those are damages that are assessed in order to punish the defendant for outrageous conduct and to deter the defendant and others from engaging in similar behavior in the future. Punitive damages are extraordinarily rare in the circuit court. We just don't see many cases in which they are awarded. They are alleged more frequently than they are awarded, but frequently don't make it through the screening process with the judge that's imposed by the statute, and other times don't make it to a jury to be decided. So we're not going to talk a lot about punitive damages. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them, but it just is not a major component of what we address in negligence or tort cases that are inside of our system. And so let's talk about economic damages. As I said, these are out of pockets. These are things that somebody's actually spent as a consequence of the tortious conduct. Past and future wage losses and the loss of earning capacity. So for that plaintiff who's injured severely and loses their job and perhaps the ability to work in the future, that is an economic damage that's verifiable. There are witnesses that come in and testify about that. They are vocational rehabilitation experts and witnesses who come in. They have a background in what it takes to do a job, what type of work requires what skill sets, as well as what physical capabilities. In addition, there are life care planners that can talk about these types of issues associated with wage loss and earning capacity. So out-of-pocket, hard dollar losses, past and future medical expenses. Again, somebody who's injured as a consequence of some sort of an incident is entitled to recover their past and future medical expenses. So the ones that they have incurred now and the ones that are anticipated to be incurred in the future. And again, this is heavily dependent upon the expert testimony of physicians, life care planners, others, rehabilitation specialists and therapists that come into trial to testify about what those past and future medical expenses are going to be. Frequently, there's some property loss or property damage loss that's associated with an incident as well. In a car accident, it could be the damage to the vehicle. Most often, those cases are resolved pretty early in the litigation, and it's sometimes not even necessary. The property damage carriers will take care of those things. Lost support and services. In certain types of cases, if the injured person was responsible for supporting others or for caring for others, we can evaluate that and value that through the testimony of experts who can put dollars together with the time. Additionally, there may be other out-of-pocket expenses. I've seen cases, for example, and less common now than it was, but when somebody could no longer qualify for health insurance as a result of suffering an injury or had to pay a higher premium for health insurance because they now came with a pre-existing injury, that was a significant out-of-pocket loss that could be claimed. There could be others. Your imagination is the only limit. The lawyers that appear in front of me on both sides of cases are very creative, and they will find ways to establish elements for out-of-pocket losses. So we've talked about economic damages. Let's talk just for a second about non-economic damages. The types are all listed in the jury instructions, and the jury instructions tell us that a person who suffered injuries is also entitled to be compensated for pain and suffering, for mental anguish, emotional distress, inconvenience, the loss of the capacity for enjoyment of life, as well as for disfigurement. So for that person, for example, who suffered a horrific burn injury, they may have significant scarring and disfigurement that will be a forever issue. It's not uncommon in trials to hear the lawyers say that if we had a magic wand, jury, if we could give you the magic wand and ask you to simply restore our client to the way that they were before this accident, wouldn't that be ideal? But that's not real life. That's not the world that we live in. And the only way that we have to compensate people who've suffered injuries and who are struggling with the after effects of that is through financial damages, through money damages. And so there's a lot of argument in cases around non-economic damages. And the jury instruction, how the jury is instructed to evaluate non-economic damages, is to award an amount that is fair and just in light of all of the evidence. There's no specific measure that if you've broken your leg and you're going to have plates and screws in an orthopedic type of repair in your leg that's going to cause pain for the rest of your life, there's no value. We don't have a calculator that says, oh, that's worth $42,000. Doesn't work that way. So we depend upon juries to evaluate all of the evidence and to award what is fair and just in the light of all of the evidence in the case. I'm sorry, let me just touch on this because we're going to get to this in just a minute, but you may be familiar with the no-fault law, or PIP. I'm sure that's a topic that's been addressed up here in the last couple of years. Under the no-fault statute, you cannot receive an award of non-economic damages, unless you can establish that you have suffered a permanent or very serious injury that meets the criteria of the statute. And so non-economic damages are limited in car accident cases to those cases where there can be established a permanent injury caused by the accident. And that's important because that is the main battleground in auto cases. That is the most contentious area. It's where we see the experts after experts on both sides of the cases. And there are a number of experts that we see on a regular basis that appear before us whose specialty is trying to help a jury understand why this accident didn't cause a permanent injury or why this accident did cause a permanent injury. So keep that in mind, that threshold rule of the no-fault statute. Unless you cross this threshold, you don't get non-economic damages. So let's talk a little bit about how damages are proved by the parties to cases. The plaintiff may prove economic and non-economic damages in a case, and they have to do that by the greater weight of the evidence, that standard that we talked about. Future medical damages take on a little additional burden, and that is the burden of proving that those damages are reasonably certain to be incurred in the future. And you can imagine why that is. We want to ensure that when a jury is awarding something for the future, that it's not speculative, that it's not guesswork about what somebody might need in the future. So we impose the burden of the greater weight of the evidence and reasonably certain to be incurred on future medical expenses. So let me just give you an example. I get involved in a car accident. I suffer an injury to my neck and to my low back that requires surgery. Surgeries associated with the neck and low back can include things like discectomies, where they take a piece of the disc that is between the vertebra out of your neck and replace it with other disc material. They might involve a fusion, putting hardware into the neck, plates and screws into the vertebra to stabilize the neck where the injury has occurred. Same thing in the low back. Many of those surgeries are one and dones, but some are not. Frequently, the hardware will come loose, and a future surgery then is necessitated to either go in and remove the hardware or to replace the hardware. When a plaintiff comes to trial, they may not yet have had a second surgery, and the doctor is going to say, I think it's likely that they are going to need this surgery. Okay, how likely, doctor? By the greater weight of the evidence, more likely than not? And are you reasonably certain that that surgery is going to be necessitated? And you'll hear the plaintiff's doctors talk about that, and then on the defense side, you'll talk about how that's entirely speculative. There's no way to know whether somebody is likely to need that surgery or not. In the vast majority of cases, they're one and done, and it's not necessary. Other cases, it may be. So you'll see damages talked about, a future damages in that context. And so the evidence that we frequently see that's introduced to the jury to prove or to defend against damages include things like medical records and bills. So that's going to be the plaintiff's medical records from this incident. Emergency room care, if there was some, follow-up care, surgeries, MRI scans, CT scans, all of the medical evidence associated with the injury claim. And then the bills from the medical providers that have provided that treatment to the plaintiff. And we're going to focus in on the medical bills here in a minute. All right, so you may have some questions about that. Just bear with me as we get to the medical bills, because that's going to be the heart of this damages conversation. But you don't just see the plaintiff introducing medical bills. You also see the defendant introducing medical records from the past. And that's significant. Many times, the defense in its discovery will learn that the plaintiff had back pain previously. And there might even be an MRI out there that has some baseline findings that now we can compare to the post-accident MRI. And again, this is the major area of contention. There's a radiologist in the Orlando area who comes in to testify on a regular basis that these injuries cannot be a result of a car accident of this magnitude, right? So that X-ray or radiologist specialist together with an accident reconstructionist. And that duo will come in and they will say, we've calculated the forces of the accident. This is where we see this, the range of speed of this collision. Black boxes don't detect accidents, by the way, up to a certain threshold level. And so the black boxes in cars may not be helpful. So the accident reconstructionist takes on the responsibility to reconstruct the accident, determine speeds and forces on the body, and then combined with the radiologist will testify. That just didn't happen as a result of this accident. That 60-year-old person has just been suffering from degenerative conditions or problems in their spine, and that's what we're seeing now, is that finally they're beginning to manifest. And that's very credible testimony, by the way. We see many cases where the plaintiff cannot establish a permanent injury as a result of an accident because of the testimony associated with accident reconstruction and experts that come in for the defense. In addition to medical bills and records on both sides, you'll also see employment records. That's critical for establishing wage loss or earning capacity claims. Additionally, there's frequently medical information contained in your employment records. You may have had an employment physical for the company that you're going to work for, or there may be other information that's been gathered by the employer that's contained in those records that might be of value. You'll see expert testimony, as we've talked about, medical and financial. That comes in the form of sometimes CPAs or accountants that will come and do analysis on earnings, the medical experts that we've talked about. And of course, there is the claimant's testimony themselves, as well as the defendant's testimony about the forces involved in the collision. Believe it or not, most people who get involved in auto accidents don't know how fast they were going at the time of the accident. Not reliably. They just don't. And so those experts, their testimony is helpful, but the experts really help to drive the points home for the jury. So the two battlegrounds inside of the evidence of damages are, number one, the medical causation, and number two, the reasonableness of the bills. Medical causation and the reasonableness of the bills. So we're going to talk a little bit about what the jury sees and hears and what they don't see and hear. You've already seen much of what the jury is permitted to see and hear. And with respect to causation, it is those medical records and experts. With respect to bills, how much are my losses? It's typically those bills. So the hospital prepares a bill after the emergency room treatment, and that bill is submitted to the jury. The chiropractor that somebody sees submits a bill, and that bill goes to the jury. The MRI scan from the MRI provider bills for that, and that goes to the jury. The surgeon does a surgery, and you see a hospital bill, a surgeon's bill, and an anesthesiologist bill associated with that surgery. And those are the bills that are boarded or seen by the jury in preparation for their decision on an award of damages in a negligence or personal injury case. But there are some things that a jury does not see. And there are two best examples of these things, and the two most critical, I think, are espoused in the non-joinder rule, which prohibits the introduction of evidence relating to liability insurance coverage. So let's take that auto accident case. Defendant hits plaintiff's car, causes injuries and damage to the plaintiff. The defendant has insurance coverage, not required by statute, by the way, but typically has insurance coverage. And that insurance carrier is considered the defendant's liability insurance carrier. The jury never hears about the existence of liability insurance coverage. Why is that? Well, that's the purpose of the non-joinder rule, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. The legislative intent behind the non-joinder statute is to ensure that the availability of insurance has no influence on the jury's determination of the insured's liability and damages. This statute has been in place for decades, and its intent is simply that. We don't want to mislead or lead the jury astray about what the existence of coverage means. And I can tell you that the most often asked question by jurors when they are in deliberations is, does the defendant have insurance? Because it changes the analysis. If the defendant has insurance coverage, the jury is assured that the defendant is not coming out of pocket for damages. And many jurors have expressed that's an easier equation. And therefore, it impacts their assessment of liability and of damages. If you've got coverage, and I'm a little iffy on whether you should be at fault, but I find out that you have insurance coverage, some jurors would say, it's much easier to answer yes to the question of negligence, because I know the defendant's not going to pay. And then the second issue is that there is a danger that the jurors will believe that the plaintiff's injuries may be greater because of the existence of insurance, or they might award more because of the existence of insurance. And so the non-joinder statute prevents the defendant's insurance company from being mentioned during trial, so the jury never knows about it, and they cannot be joined in the lawsuit. Now, that's liability insurance. There are other types of insurance that do come into play in trials. If you carry, for example, uninsured motorist coverage, and the driver that strikes you does not have enough insurance coverage to pay for your own damages, your own uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage will come into play. And if they don't offer enough money to resolve a case, they can be sued directly in the lawsuit. And the jury is aware that there is insurance coverage in play. They don't know how much, but they understand the relationship between the plaintiff and the plaintiff's own insurance company. So this non-joinder rule only applies to auto accident or injury cases and the liability insurance coverage, the tortfeasor or wrongdoer's insurance coverage. The second, we've covered all of that. And under the non-joinder statute, if a plaintiff is successful in getting a verdict against an insured, then the insurance company can then be joined after the jury verdict has been rendered for purposes of collection, attorney's fees, costs, and whatever the principal amounts that are due are, if there's an attorney's fee issue or in the case. The second thing that the jury doesn't hear about are collateral sources. And this is the most complex part of what we're going to talk about today, so bear with me. And please feel free to ask me questions as we get through this. Collateral sources are simply payments that are made to the claimant or made on the claimant's behalf by a third party, typically an insurer, as a result of the plaintiff's injuries. And typical collateral sources are things like private health insurance, auto insurance that provides medical or disability coverage, Social Security payments, employee salary continuation plans. Those are all some examples of things that the jury does not hear about. And I'm going to explain to you why in just a minute it is so confusing for them and what the policies are, again, behind the statute that's 768.76. And it might be helpful to know a little history. If you remember back to your civics class in high school, or if you, those of you that are law students may remember, that the collateral source rule comes from the English common law, which we adopted here in the United States. And the intent of the collateral source rule was to permit an injured person to recover their full damages from a wrongdoer, irrespective of the payment of any element of those damages from a source that's independent of the wrongdoer. The rule rested on this concept of justice that a tortfeasor, the wrongdoer, shouldn't benefit from an injured party's foresight in contracting for protection against injuries. In other words, the wrongdoer should bear the full burden of their wrongful act. And if the plaintiff thought ahead and said, you know, if I got this kind of insurance, that would protect me in the event of some wrongdoer, that's to the plaintiff's good. Candidly, it permitted a windfall in some circumstances where the plaintiff might actually obtain a double recovery. They would recover from the wrongdoer, and they would recover from their own insurance, their own foresight to protect against wrongdoers. We recognize that. As a result, the Florida legislature has passed this collateral source rule, and we address, through the collateral source rule and post-verdict set-offs, any potential windfalls to plaintiffs, so that there is no provision for a plaintiff to make a double recovery under the terms of the collateral source rule. So we're going to talk about that some more, but what's the policy? It's very similar to the policy of the non-joinder rule. And it is the idea that the introduction of collateral source evidence misleads the jury on the issue of liability and subverts the jury process. Evidence of collateral source benefits can lead a jury to believe that the plaintiff will in fact or is trying to obtain a double or triple recovery for their injuries. And it changes the jury dynamic from one of a fair evaluation of the damages to instead trying to figure out what's this going to mean? This plaintiff's going to get paid twice? That's wrong. We can't have that. And failing to award damages that the law says should be awarded and allowing the court to address the outcome of the collateral source issues. The collateral source rule is a rule of both evidence and damages. It prevents the introduction of evidence of collateral source payments, and that's an evidence rule, and as a damage rule, gives to the court the responsibility to ensure that those collateral sources are accounted for in the ultimate verdict that is awarded. So this is probably let's just talk about this. This is the practical concern. And this came up in a case for me yesterday. This is an everyday issue for us in the circuit court. There is some case law that allows a jury to hear that Medicare has paid past medical expenses and only allows the plaintiff to board or post what Medicare paid as the total amount of the bill that they can seek recovery from the jury for. So if somebody who is eligible for Medicare suffers an injury as a consequence of an accident, presents their case to a jury, the Medicare reimbursement rate, which I understand not to bear any relationship to the value of the service, but instead, Medicare reimbursement rates are related to the amount of money available in the federal budget to pay for Medicare benefits and is negotiated on a relative value-based system. The jury hears that amount. So if the MRI in the free market retail costs $1,000, but under Medicare it's paid for at $200, that's what the jury hears as that element of the damages. Okay, that's the law. My job is to apply it. I got that. But in this particular case, the plaintiff was telling me that this individual had initially private health insurance that was paying the bills. Same MRI under private health insurance was paid at a contracted rate. Different, of course, than a Medicare reimbursement rate. The Medicare reimbursement rate only comes in if Medicare has a right of subrogation. When I say subrogation, think reimbursement. They have the right to be reimbursed for what they paid. So a plaintiff who puts on a Medicare bill, gets a verdict for that Medicare bill, has to then pay the money back to Medicare. All right, that's just part of the system. That's all good and well, except that now Medicare has agreed to assert a lien for only some of the bills that it's paid and has not agreed to pay or not agreed to seek reimbursement for other bills that it has paid. So we've got private insurance at a contracted rate, we've got Medicare at a Medicare rate, and then we have Medicare where they're not seeking reimbursement, so that bill doesn't come in at all. And the jury has to figure out why those three MRIs that are the same MRI are all in at different rates. That they're awarding nothing for the last MRI. The Medicare rate for the middle one and the private health insurance rate for the third one. And that situation is complicated even further in an auto accident case where under our PIP statute, our no-fault statute, we have scheduled fees that are at 200% of the Medicare rate for an MRI. So you could potentially have four MRIs, same condition, not uncommon, by the way. We see lots of diagnostic studies, particularly with neck and back injuries. Four MRIs with four different rates of reimbursement and giving that to the jury to try to determine not only the award of past medical expenses, but an amount that also serves as the predicate sometimes for future medical expenses. When a doctor testifies that he's going to need MRIs on a periodic basis because we've got to evaluate that hardware to determine if it needs to be repaired or replaced, and so to try to determine how do you award that in the future. So those are the challenges. You could add to that Medicaid as well. It's not uncommon that you have somebody who gets involved in a serious car accident, loses their job, so they get their PIP, they had private health insurance, then they lose their job, now they're eligible for Medicaid. And then if they age out in that time, they're gonna get Medicare as well. So you have these four or five possible multiple payers associated with the benefits for an auto accident and the damages that are awardable. So I think this is a good breaking point for us. I'm sure there are questions and follow-up to that.
Thank you, Judge Myers. Representative Roach, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you again, Your Honor. So I know that this is statutory and you're not sort of the arbiter of how things should be, but I'd love to get your opinion. And I'm having a hard time sort of understanding why, you know, private health insurance and Social Security employment salary would be collateral sources, but Medicare, Medicaid, life insurance benefits would not be. And I guess what I'm struggling with is because when you look at both of those, I mean, even Medicare, I mean, people have paid into that through payroll taxes for, you know, their whole lives or premiums. So people pay for all of that. I'm not quite sure why one would be considered a collateral source and one would not.
I have to be especially careful in addressing questions like this with respect, Representative Roach, and I have an opinion. My opinion's irrelevant. As a judge and a neutral arbiter of the law and the facts, my job is to apply the law, and I don't have the luxury of choosing how I might like the law to be, and I'm very conscious not to write the law as a circuit judge. I don't think that's my role. I can only tell you that there are practical issues that are raised in the courtroom, in trial, that are solved by the application of the collateral source rule. By the idea that, and we're going to talk through some examples here in just a few minutes, about what this looks like on the ground when we're confronted with the application. It is a challenge, and our healthcare system seems to have become more complex in the manner in which certain medical services are reimbursed, and we do have multiple different sources of payment. Mm-hmm. That is simply the challenge that we're confronted with, and I don't mean to dodge your question. That's really not my intent, but I just think I respect that's within your purview to try to assess and address.
Follow up?
Thank you, Your Honor. No, I certainly understand, as you refer to sort of the practical reasons why we need the collateral source rule, and I'm not arguing against it. I'm just struggling with, you know, how a future legislative body made that distinction between what should or should not be a collateral source, because I think the similarities of what is and what isn't, to me, outweigh the differences. But thank you for your...
And in follow-up to that, there is a pending case in front of the Florida Supreme Court right now that addresses the Medicare issue. As you see from the statute, Medicare is not considered a collateral source and therefore is admissible as it relates to past medical expenses by virtue of a judicial decision interpreting the collateral source rule. The question has arisen whether that same prohibition should apply to Medicare for future. And so far, the courts have been consistent in saying, no, you're not guaranteed to have that source of reimbursement for your medical expenses. And so the courts have ruled consistently in that fashion, are now asking the question, should we be allowing Medicare for past medical expenses? And because of the confusion that it causes. And I'll have an issue to confront in my case. It's a medical malpractice case, again, that we're going to be trying in 2 weeks. And I'm going to have to make the decision, do I allow it in light of the prospects and potential for confusion when I know I can solve the issue on the back end through the set-off process that the court engages in pursuant to the collateral source rule.
Thank you. Representative Gregory, you're recognized.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Your Honor. I think you're right that we are now getting to the meat of it. There's certainly a lot of discussion that we all hear from a variety of well, all of the interest parties, right? We hear from defense attorneys and plaintiff's attorneys, insurance companies, medical community, and a lot of it is on the collateral source rule, and I think in particular how it applies to letters of protection. So I wonder if you could just provide some more details on, you know, how does collateral source rule work for letters of protection?
Sure. So for the benefit of the committee members that may not be familiar with a letter of protection, in the plaintiff's practice, it is not uncommon for a doctor to undertake treatment of an injured person who does not have insurance benefits to be able to pay the costs of that medical treatment. And you'll see it, for example, in a surgery case where the doctor agrees to do surgery, but he'll only do it with the benefit of a letter from the lawyer and from the client, the injured person, agreeing to protect the doctor's bill out of any potential recovery from the lawsuit. And so the doctor retains the right to collect his bill from the plaintiff directly. And if the plaintiff is successful in the lawsuit, then the plaintiff agrees to use the lawsuit proceeds to pay that bill. That's a letter of protection. Letters of protection are admissible in evidence because they do establish or arguably establish a bias on the part of the doctor who is testifying in the case, who is going to, it is argued, be more likely to say your injury is permanent to get you over the threshold, and that this surgery was reasonable, necessary, and related to this accident, so that jury award the plaintiff that bill so I can get paid. So the law has evolved that those are admissible for impeachment purposes to show a bias on the part of the doctor, and we routinely hear about those from the defense in cases. The letter of protection amounts to a bill that for which there is a right of reimbursement, and therefore it is considered a collateral source, and that bill would be addressed by the court if necessary, but there's no reason to address it because it is payable. And whether the jury awards money to the plaintiff or not, the plaintiff is still responsible for that bill. If the jury reduces the medical bills, decides not to award the full amount that the plaintiff seeks, that bill is still payable by the individual plaintiff. So it is, I think, one of those bills that comes into evidence with that impeachment evidence, understanding that it may or may not be awarded, but it's still owed. Does that answer the question, Representative?
I think it's a follow-up. Representative Gregory, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it does. I do have a couple follow-ups, but I'll skip one. I'll say I would love to hear, but I know you can't tell us, given your capacity as circuit judge, you know, your opinion on whether letters of protection are necessary, are they helpful, are they being abused or not? But I understand that you couldn't answer that. But I would like to know, back to your point earlier, that auto accidents are the source of the majority of the cases, a majority of the caseload are from auto accidents. And we've certainly discussed for several years repealing PIP and switching to bodily injury. I'm wondering what you think the impact would be on the caseload of the court system if we made that kind of move.
Let me clarify what I said earlier just to make sure that I was clear. I don't know that they're the majority of cases, but they're the majority of trials. So they take up an inordinate amount of our trial time on dockets, and so we appreciate that. The business cases, the collections cases, I think the collections cases are probably the majority of the cases that we receive. It's credit card collection cases, it's liens, it's vendor bills that aren't paid, those types of things. But it is a substantial portion of the docket. I look at my docket on a regular basis of new filings, and you know, I'll see a medical malpractice case one in every 50 cases, 60 cases, 70 cases. It's fairly rare. Auto accident cases, a substantial portion. I happen to practice in a market in which there are very strong plaintiff law firm influences, marketing and advertising, and so we see a lot of car accident cases. And I think your question was whether whether modifications to that would be beneficial to the court or assist us with workload.
Thank you, Chair. Just whether or not if we change from the system we have now to a bodily injury system, do you think that would increase the number of trials for auto accidents?
That's really difficult for me to tell. I just don't know. I don't evaluate things in the same way that you all do as legislators, and again, defer to your expertise and knowledge about that.
Thank you, Representative Fernandez-Berkey, and you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and if I have permission to have a dialogue with the judge.
Yes.
Thank you. So, Judge, you mentioned specifically the amounts, the insurance amounts, right, the Medicare amounts, the reimbursable rates for Medicare. But in addition to that, I mean, isn't it also a potential that the plaintiff negotiates with Medicare prior to the trial and can further reduce a Medicare lien, essentially reducing what's owed to Medicare? Is that possible?
I think that there have been negotiations that occur. My experience and my awareness of those negotiations is frequently negotiating what is related and what is not to mm-hmm. the accident. It's not uncommon for lien holders, in my awareness from, I've had a few hearings related to these issues, and so the issues come up where we see that Medicare's saw that you had an accident on this date and you are seeking to resolve your claim through this date, and they just take everything in that date and in that date range and say, well, that must be related to the accident. But you may have seen your doctor for a dialysis, you know, which clearly wasn't related. And so that frequently I think the negotiations are to exclude those things that are unrelated. I don't know Medicare's policies or willingness to negotiate on the balances that would be owed under the terms of the system. I can't know that I can directly address that issue.
Okay. So
I suspect there are many negotiations, though, with medical providers, not just Medicare, not just the payers, but sometimes directly with the providers that are mm-hmm. owed monies. And I suspect there are negotiations on those issues as well.
To your knowledge, do those negotiated amounts also, are they heard at trial, or is it just a base rate?
I don't think the negotiations take place until after trial, mm-hmm. when there's a knowledge of what pot of money is available to try to pay bills. I do frequently see where cases don't resolve for the full amount of bills at verdict or in settlement. I will frequently see attempts by attorneys to negotiate on the behalf of their clients to resolve all of the medical bills for reduced rates to try to capture them all within the settlement amount. Okay. So I may have $200,000 worth of medical bills. The defendant only had $100,000 liability coverage. Settle the case for $100,000 and then attempt to bring those $200,000 of bills to within the $100,000 limit to try to resolve the plaintiff's responsibility or liability for bills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just trying to get at that there's a potential windfall basically for the at-fault party when the negotiation takes place, because there's a potential for, you know, a higher amount of damages than there's some sort of negotiation that takes place. So it's essentially a windfall for the at-fault party, leaving the victim essentially, you know, potentially holding the bag.
I it could be. I don't know the answer to that from firsthand experience. In the last 11 years, I can tell you as a lawyer, certainly I negotiated in ways that I hoped was to my client's benefit mm-hmm. for that type of circumstance. But I really can't comment any further than that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judge. I went way back. I just wanted to ask, you mentioned that one of the things that jurors are always interested in is, does somebody have insurance? Are they allowed to ask you how much insurance that individual has?
No, I mean, they can ask.
But you can't tell them.
I can't tell them, right? And we don't tell them, in response to their question asking if there is insurance, we do not tell them that. And in fact, in our jury instructions, we have specific instructions that tell jurors not to speculate or consider. If sometimes you'll hear inadvertently a mention of insurance during trial. So we have jury instructions to tell the jury not to consider that, that it's not relevant to their deliberations.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again, for Judge, for the valuable presentation. I'm going to dive real deep into the weeds, if that's all right, for
all
a second. So going back a couple slides, there was, I mean, you don't have to go back, but I'm going to go back in my question. You may as well put it up. But we're talking about collateral source and non-joinder. I'm going to conflate them for the purpose of this question. I understand the distinction, but there's some sort of interplay with subrogation. And it seems that taking subrogation, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that if the claims are subject to subrogation, they're not subject to those doctrines. Perhaps I misunderstood you. It seems that the issue of subrogation is exactly the type of thing that, going back to the English common law, we don't consider, in other words, the plaintiff seeking a double recovery or not getting a double recovery if it's subject to subrogation, as the case may be. So why are we considering? And then the second part of my question is there are things that you listed that were not, that were subject to subrogation and not subject to subrogation. And thank you. So, for example, Social Security, some of these things, I would be surprised if those insurers didn't put a subrogation clause. Maybe they don't. Maybe there's some statutory bar. But as far as I'm concerned, subrogation could apply to all seven of those categories. So if you could, are we doing the right thing? Is there a hole in the collateral source rule or a hole in a non-joinder statute? Or are we doing the right thing here? You know, is really where I'm going.
I don't know that it would be appropriate for me to come in on right or wrong. What I think I can say is that the system manages well these issues with rare exceptions. And so I think the vast majority of times the rules that we have in place are helpful, and they get us through trial and to a post-verdict set-off situation if necessary. And the issues that are brewing or bubbling now inside of the appellate courts, and it is primarily this Medicare issue and the appropriateness of the presentation of that evidence at trial and what the implications of that are. And I don't hesitate to, or I would hesitate to make a guess about where that likely falls, but I know it's in the right place. The Supreme Court's going to decide it, and we're going to evaluate, you know, we just apply it at that point. But I should say this too. We try cases involving health insurance benefits, Medicare, Medicaid, PIP, all of these things. And I have very few post-verdict hearings. It is not creating a significant burden on the courts under its current structure. So I would tell you in the last 6 years, if I've had three set-off hearings, I think I'm overestimating. 6.5 years on the civil bench, 11 years as a judge. And in talking with my colleagues in preparation for this, it's just not a common thing that occurs. The lawyers are working it out because they've got the guidance that they need. And the way lawyers know this, but if you're a non-lawyer, the way that lawyers work things out is if there's predictability in the system, if they can anticipate what the judge is going to do because the law is clear, they work it out. They resolve it. And I think that's happening the vast majority of the time.
Can I just ask?
Yes, we have a couple more questions, if we can.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. That one was very compound. Let me just ask a much better, simpler question. Why are we saying that collateral sources do not include subrogation? What is the public policy reason for that? And I'm trying to ask something you can answer if I've done that. But I think...
Yeah. My interpretation as a judge applying the law, and not presuming to understand the intentions, but my interpretation is that for those things where there's a right of subrogation or reimbursement, the jury should hear and have the opportunity to award the entire amount because the plaintiff's going to have to pay it back, or is at risk of having to pay it back in response, I think, to Representative Fernandez Barkin's question. I think they're at risk of having to pay it back. Whether it gets negotiated or not, I don't know, outside my bailiwick.
Representative Duggan, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Your Honor. This is very helpful, very informative. I appreciate the time you're taking with us today. I want to circle back to the letter of protection issue that Majority Whip Gregory raised. I'm under the understanding, admittedly from stakeholders in the process who have a perspective. So I want to ask you this question. Have you seen a dynamic whereby after the original action that involved a letter of protection that either there was a verdict or a settlement based on the letter, the amount of the letter, the plaintiff attorney then files an interpleader action against the medical provider seeking to reduce the amount of that the medical provider is actually going to recover? Have you seen that in your experience?
Yes.
Okay.
But it's in those circumstances where the recovery is not sufficient to pay all of the medical bills. And so the interpleader arises because of a limited recovery with a large amount of bills and a desire to try to resolve all the bills for the limited available pot. And so we do very occasionally see that.
Two quick follow-ups. So when that occurs, is there an amendment to the original verdict to reflect that the reduction in the payment to the letter of protection provider?
No amendment to the verdict, no amendment to the judgment. But again, the context is that not enough money was awarded to the plaintiff to cover all of their bills. And so it's an effort in fairness to try to resolve as many of the bills as are possible with a limited pool of money.
Second follow-up.
Yes.
Right. So, okay, thank you. In that scenario, for purposes of my hypothetical, let's say the plaintiff's attorney presents evidence to the court of some sort that the medical provider's recovery should be reduced because the amount in the letter of protection wasn't the actual cost of providing the service. Let's say there was, you know, some additional surplusage in there for potentially this exact scenario, and the medical provider provides a cushion in their fee estimate. If the plaintiff's attorney provides that evidence to the court as the basis for reducing the letter of protection provider's recovery, for purposes of my hypothetical, let's say that evidence existed, the plaintiff's attorney had it and presented it to the court took it in, what would be the public policy for excluding that exact same evidence in the underlying original action?
I could only say I've never seen that. I've never seen a circumstance where a plaintiff has made a full recovery and then sought to reduce the medical bills in an interpleader action in front of the court. And I don't think it would fly. Because interpleader says I have competing claims to the money, I don't know how to distribute it, and so I'm going to give it to the court, join all these folks, and let them duke it out for the money. That's not the situation in a full recovery. In a full recovery, I don't know that I've ever seen an occasion before me to seek to reduce those bills on some basis. And there are... I can imagine some reasons why attorneys would not want to do that if they had made a full recovery. There are only a limited number of doctors that are available to treat individuals who suffered injuries. Only some of them are financially capable of working under letters of protection. And you would not want to sour or destroy relationships, I would imagine, with those providers for the benefit of future injured folks that might hire you. I can't honestly say that I've ever seen that.
Representative Diamond, you recognize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Your Honor. I have a similar series of questions, or I guess one question really relating to this letter of protection issue. You know, obviously we're in a free country, and if I want to go out and contract with a doctor to, you know, treat me based on a recovery, we can do that. And we've had these debates as a committee about, are we going to set sort of central price controls on that, or is that not something we want to do? But you were talking about the fact that the relationship between the physician, the treating physician who's testifying, and the plaintiff is subject to discovery, and that the litigation experience will get to the truth. And it's been argued by business groups and insurance interests I've seen in this committee and elsewhere in court that there are limitations on that under our state case law, that they can't really get at that relationship. Is that, where is the state of our state case law on that issue? I mean, in other words, can that To the extent that a defendant wants to argue there's financial bias here and disregard that, I mean, or that the bill is unreasonable, can those issues be fully litigated?
I think that the case law has developed to the place that the relationship between a plaintiff and a medical provider is fully discoverable and fully admissible. I think the area maybe that folks are referencing for you are the relationships between defense law firms and certain medical providers that testify as experts, defense insurance companies and medical providers that provide expert testimony, and on the flip side, plaintiffs' law firms and experts that frequently treat clients or plaintiffs that are associated with those law firms. And that law, I would tell you, is still developing. I think it is quite clear now, based upon some decisions of the Supreme Court within the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks now, that the relationship between defense law firms and defense insurance companies and the experts that they utilize to testify are fully, the financial piece of that is fully discoverable at this point. The relationship between plaintiffs' law firms and experts does not appear to be fully developed, and right now there is not a basis for the discovery between a plaintiff's law firm and the physician that is treating an individual plaintiff. But that's very much, I would say, in play in the court system at this point.
Thank you. And, Your Honor, we have just under 15 minutes left, and so I would ask that based on the questions we've had, if you wouldn't mind moving to the set-off portion of your presentation, and we'll have to save the verdict form, I think, for another day. That way we might be able to get in a couple of
happy
questions.
To do that.
Thank you.
So let me talk a little bit about set-offs. Under the collateral source rule, the court is obligated to conduct post-verdict set-offs with respect to certain collateral sources that there is evidence of but which were not presented during trial. The set-off procedure is a balancing of policy. It is the collateral source evidence rule, but also preventing windfalls. Those two policies in play for the set-off process. And so generally, if a portion of the bill has been paid by or is owed by the claimant, like a deductible, a copay, or some outstanding balance, if that's owed by the plaintiff, or if it's owed back to somebody, a workers' comp insurance carrier has a lien, health insurance has a lien, Medicare has a lien, Medicaid has a lien, it is not set off post-verdict. So if the money is owed, and Representative Fernandez-Barquez, this I think it goes directly to your question. If it is owed, it is not set off. So the court's not going to set it off. If a portion of the bill is not owed back to somebody and it's not owed by the plaintiff, it is set off post-verdict. And this is how we seek to prevent the double recovery issue. And I've got three examples here that I think explain it pretty well. And I'm going to read a little bit, and you'll forgive me, but I think if we just walk through this situation. So here's the scenario. A plaintiff has health insurance that does have a right of subrogation, a right of being reimbursed, and the plaintiff paid deductibles or copays out of his or her own pocket. So in this case, the retail bill for the doctor's visit is $100. I'll use round numbers, forgive me. The health insurance payment was $50. Remember, health insurance has a right to be reimbursed for that $50. There was a $40 contractual discount or adjustment under the health insurance policy, and the patient either paid or owes $10 as their copay. So because the claimant paid or owes the $10, it's not set off. Because the claimant owes the $50 that was paid by the insurer back to the insurer, it is not set off. But because the claimant doesn't owe the $40 that was the contractual discount, it is set off. So as a result, post-verdict, that $100 bill that was awarded by the jury is reduced by the $40 of the contractual discount that the plaintiff never owed. All right? Now, all of this is subject, we're taking a pretty high-level view at this, so you'll forgive me, But there are some more details in the collateral source statute. For example, one of the things the plaintiff gets to do is to show how much they paid in premiums for health insurance. And that's offset against the offset, because they had to pay for it to get it, to get the benefit of that $40 contractual discount. So we give them that back. But that shows you claimant's net recovery is $60. That's the $10 to pay the copay and $50 that they owe back to health insurance for subrogation. No windfall to the plaintiff. Second example, this is Medicare. There are no copays that are owed under Medicare, and Medicare has a right of subrogation, the right to be reimbursed for what they pay. The retail value of the doctor's bill is $100. The Medicare allowable amount is $20, and it's adjusted by $80. The result, because Medicare has a right of subrogation, is that the claimant's $100 award is reduced to $20. Because they owe Medicare that back. They have to recover it in order to pay Medicare back. The $80 adjustment is set off. The plaintiff does not recover the $80 that they do not owe. Third scenario, health insurance with no right of subrogation. There are some health insurance policies that do not seek to get reimbursed for medicals they pay associated with accidents. In this case, the bill is $100. Health insurance pays the doctor $50. Writes off $50 because that's contractual discount. Post-verdict, health insurer has no right to be repaid, and the claimant doesn't owe the adjusted amount, so the entire bill is set off, and the plaintiff recovers zero for that medical bill. No windfall to the plaintiff. So this is probably a good breaking point. Any questions about those scenarios or that type of an analysis?
Representative Roach, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Your Honor. This has been enlightening. I feel like I have a really good torts professor here asking great questions. You know, you had mentioned several times about the need to balance policy and protect against windfalls for the plaintiff, but it seems to me when we're talking about post-verdict set-offs that the defendant, the tortfeasor, is always getting the benefit of any reductions to medical care. And if you approach tort law with the idea that the tortfeasor, that the public policy goal is for the tortfeasor to bear the full burden of their wrongful act, that seems wrong to me. I'm just curious to get your thoughts or comments on that.
Avoiding the policy implications of that, I think that the original collateral source rule had exactly that intent. The common law collateral source rule would have allowed even double recovery or triple recovery to the plaintiff if they had the foresight to contract for some coverages. But the legislature and its purview and wisdom has made the decision that we're not going to do that, but we're going to get everybody back to an even or level playing field. And I think that is the clearest expression of the intent that I can garner from that. I still don't know, Representative Fernandez-Barkin, about this negotiation issue and whether there's the potential. But again, I think Representative Roach's question and the policy behind the original collateral source rule would say that if that happens, it happens. It doesn't benefit the wrongdoer. It might benefit the victim. That would be an argument. But those are policy levels above my pay, or, you know, above my pay grade.
Representative Byrd, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Judge, for your presentation today. With respect to the set-offs and for the non-lawyers, this is a judicially created process, correct? This is not a statutory process with the scenarios you've gone through.
No, this is a statutory dictated process under the collateral source rule. We're just following through on it, and this is what it looks like. But again, these are pretty rare hearings. I think the vast majority of times they're worked out between the parties.
Follow up? Yes. And in your experience, is this process, as it's currently being applied by the judiciary, working to prevent windfalls?
I think so is probably the best answer I can give you, but I don't know that for certain because of the issue, again, that Representative Fernandez-Barkin has raised, and that is what negotiations may go on post-verdict, even post-set-off, between a plaintiff and their medical providers or plaintiff's law firm and their medical providers. That possibility exists, but it's beyond the scope of what I would have involvement with as a judge. I'd be speculating to say.
Your Honor, I'll give you a couple minutes to wrap up your presentation. I think we are done with questions.
Thank you. Thank you. So the last piece of this puzzle is just a reminder that pursuant to statute, the court is also charged with the responsibility upon a proper motion from the parties to review a verdict to determine whether it is excessively high or excessively low. Shocks the conscience of the court how low it might have been or how high it might have been. And the court, in that case, can adjust the ultimate award by additor or remittitor, by adding to the verdict or remitting, taking away from the verdict. So this is sort of the final check in the process on the outcome of a jury case to ensure that a jury hasn't been improperly influenced by something that happened during the trial that has inflamed their emotions or passions to the place where the verdict is not a fair consequence. I just want to, in closing, say this. Juries work hard. I am so impressed when I have the chance to speak to jurors following a trial at how hard they have worked to get to the result that they have given us in cases. Are there bad verdicts? It happens. It is so rare, I just can't tell you. I have only one time in 11 years taken a verdict away from a jury because I felt like they those six people are the only people that listen to the evidence in a case, the admissible evidence, hashed it out back there in that jury room with their collective memory, judgment, common sense, and experiences, and reached a result that I think is in the range of where cases ought to be resolved. And we are right, in my view, to trust juries with that process. We don't get plaintiff's juries, and we don't get defense juries. If you've ever watched jury selection, you'll know it's not getting to pick who you want, it's getting to pick who you don't want on the panel. Right? It's a process of exclusion, not a process necessarily of inclusion. And so we end up with these mixes of people. And if you walk outside jury rooms, it's not uncommon to hear them shouting at each other, respectfully. I've walked in and our whiteboards are covered with calculations and notes and angles and theories about issues. I have tremendous confidence in their ability to get these damages issues right in the range of reasonable. And so I think it's why we see so little of this post-verdict work in the judiciary on the circuit bench. So I want to thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Myers, for being here. And thank you very much. As a practitioner in this space, I've long understood the complexity of the issues that are placed before the jury, the difficulty of the process to make sure that there's fairness for both sides, and the work that goes on in the post-verdict set-off proceedings. And I think I appreciate the education today, not only for myself, but for my colleagues, so that we have a better understanding of these complex issues as we're presented with policy discussions around changes to statute and the process. So thank you very much for being here and the time that you have dedicated in service to our state and in preparation for today. Thank you.
Thank you much, Chair.
And with that, seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Beltran moves that we adjourn, and without objection, we are adjourned.